This program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
And a good Saturday morning to you, starting off at a little different time because of that Gopher basketball game, which starts at 12:30, our pregame coverage. So we've got a little 30-minute head start here in the Law Show. Denny Long filling in for the vacationing Steve Thompson, and seeing a fellow across the studio here I hadn't seen for quite some time. Tom Schroyer is with us. Nice to see you again, Tom.
Great to be here. It's always fun to come in on a Saturday, especially when Bruce has some weather to talk about. It adds a little bit of a jolt of adrenaline to the air.
Yeah, and it might keep you in here for about 2.5 days, too.
Exactly.
Extending the show. But anyway, it's fun to be here. I'm glad a chance. I have a feeling this is going to be a fun show, so I'm kind of glad I'm even more glad to help Steve out today. What are we going to do today?
Well, we're joined, first of all, by Kevin Bush. Denny, Kevin is the chair of Moss & Barnett's Commercial Law Department. He's also a director of our firm and plays a key role in our management. And Kevin has devoted much of his career to dealing with issues of commercial law, which include banking and financial institutions. And we like to say that Kevin is a banker's lawyer, and he has a practice that focuses heavily on working with banks of all stripes and sizes and varieties. Kevin, welcome.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be back.
You've been here about 3 or 4 times already, I know, on our show on various topics. And today we're going to delve into the second installment of our series on a very big topic in the law, and that's the Uniform Commercial Code.
We started with some general concepts about the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code, a couple of months ago. We talked about how the UCC is a broad statute that covers all kinds of commercial transactions for both individuals and businesses. Today, I thought we'd talk about checks.
Right, and that arises in a particular part of the Uniform Commercial Code. As I understand it, it's Article 3.
Articles 3 and 4.
I stand corrected. It has been a long time since I studied this in law school, and thankfully that was the last time I had to get into it. Although I know it's a fun topic, and it really is an interesting topic because checks are ubiquitous. We are all using them, even though we have ATMs and EFTs and wire transfers and debit cards and credit cards. It really is amazing, Kevin, the statistics around check use.
We still write billions of checks every year in this country. Next year will be my 30th year practicing UCC law, and I think from the very beginning I've heard about how we're moving to a checkless society. But here we are 30 years later, and we're still writing billions of checks. And I expect that my successor in this chair 30 years from now will still be dealing with check law.
Why do you think that is, Kevin, if I may ask that question, if it's not impertinent here? Because it seems to me that the logic of having a card to swipe or of having an automatic bill payment to set up and an automatic payroll deposit is just too strong, too efficient and easy for us to not eventually go that way 100%.
The electronic payment systems do provide some great speed, some low cost, very efficient processing, but checks actually do better in certain circumstances, particularly for isolated transactions. So, for instance, when I write a check, I don't need to make sure that I have a compatible electronic system with the person who is receiving it. I don't need to get an account number in advance. If the power goes out or my internet connection goes down, I can still write a check, which I can't do with the electronic payments. In a check, I also have the opportunity to include special features, such as multiple payees, which we'll talk about in a moment. Also might have settlement language in a check to settle a dispute, or I might have some other contractual undertaking. With a check, I also get a nice paper trail with perhaps even a receipt in the form of a payee's endorsement. But what's happened in the last couple of years is we've now had hybrid systems. So when I write a check, for instance, to my credit card company, when I look at my bank statement, it does not come back as a check. halfway through the process, the credit card company converts my check into an electronic payment. And what comes back is as if I had done an ATM withdrawal, and it shows up on my bank statement that way. So it's sort of the best of both systems, and I expect to see that grow in use over the next coming years.
So checks aren't going to go out of fashion?
Don't think so.
All right. And, of course, checks also are available more to certain segments of our society than these other exotic, somewhat still exotic, electronic forms of payment.
Yes.
And that's for a variety of reasons that we'll be talking about. I wanted to say, Denny, that we are going to use this week another question here at the start of our program that we'd like to put out to folks and then suggest that they can text in here to the studio their answers, and we'll give the answer to the question at the end of the program here today. And I wonder if this would be a good time to share the question with our listeners so they can start thinking of perhaps an answer.
I'm going to do that, but if I can just add something, I feel like a dinosaur sometime, or maybe I'm like a smoker inside a room I shouldn't be. When I start writing a check, people look at me like, "You're still doing that?" I mean, have you seen that? I mean, you guys still write checks like you used to?
Well, I think that one advertisement for the fast food restaurant that shows people, or maybe it's a credit card, shows people all doing their debit card swipe, and somebody wants to pay cash. I feel embarrassed when I'm paying cash, exactly, well, alone a check.
The late George Carlin did a bit on that, somebody buying a stick of gum and running the credit card. Carry some change with you, for crying out loud. All right. Can I pose this question?
Sure.
Now? All right. Very good. And here it is. And I'm going to give – let me give the text number first, 81807, 81807. Here is the question. We want you to text the answer. A check may be written only on a check form approved by the bank. I'll run it by you again. A check may be written only on a check form approved by the bank.
We'll have the answer at in the final segment of the program at the as we head into the 12:30 time segment. And but Kevin, what is a check? Let's ask that question first of all. What is a check as compared to some other forms of instruments that we might want to distinguish it from in this conversation?
A check is a direction to a bank to pay money to a third party.
Period.
Period.
Okay.
And. We have a whole series of rules in the Uniform Commercial Code and also in some federal regulations, particularly issued by the Federal Reserve Board, that flesh that out and tell us more about what checks need to say, can't say, should say, and we'll try to talk about that through the rest of the program here.
All right. Now, I know what we're going to do is you've worked up a series of questions that you want to pose here, and then we're going to answer those questions. You will answer them to me as we go through the program. But you wanted to get all these questions out right away, I know, initially. And maybe we should alternate these, and so we break them up a little bit. Maybe I'll give the first one, and then we can take it every other one from there.
All right, but let's make it easy. We'll make these all true-false questions, and I think we have seven. Each is designed to illustrate a particular point about check law.
All right, very good. Well, the first one is, and I'll read it from our list here, the endorsement on the back of a check must match the name on the front exactly.
True or false?
True or false. All right, what's the second question?
Number two, true or false, a check that is over 6 months old will not be paid.
I'm interested in the answer to that one. All right, next question. A check must state the dollar amount in both words and numbers.
All right, true or false?
True or false.
Number four, true or false, a check made payable to John and Mary can successfully be negotiated by either of them.
Five, a post-dated check will not be paid until the date on the check.
Again, true or false. Number six, a check is good unless it is rejected by the bank before the end of the next business day after it is presented for payment.
And finally,
these get more complicated as
all right,
we go along.
All right, so people have to listen. I do too. Finally, if there is insufficient money in an account to cover all checks presented on that account on any given day, the bank will pay the biggest checks first. True or false? All right. Now, I know this is a setup job because I know you well enough, but how are we going to approach the answer on this one?
Well, I tell you what. I think what I want to do is take a break right now, and then we'll come back, because I got to hear some of these answers myself. All right, stand by, everybody. This is The Law Show, a little earlier edition today, presented by our friends at Moss and Barnett here on News Radio 830 WCCO. And welcome back to Minnesota Law. Denny Long in for the vacationing Steve Thompson. Before I throw it back to Tom Schroyer, I'm going to repeat this. If you just joined us, I've got a question for you. And we'll give you the answer a little bit later on. But here's the question, and I want you to text us what you think the answer is. Text number, by the way, 81807. Here's the question in case you missed it. A check may be written only on a check form approved by the bank. A check may be written only on a check form approved by the bank. We'll keep people on the edge of their seats, Tom.
Exactly. Well, and of course, so we need all the help we can get talking about the Uniform Commercial Code, Article 3 and Article 4, which deal with bank checks, how they work, what the law is governing them, and something that we all of us rely on very heavily, as we're pointing out here, on a very constant, continuous basis. Kevin, we posed these questions here earlier on the program, and now we're going to start digging into them one by one.
Well, you said at the break, this probably is a setup, and you're right, it was. The answer to all the questions is false. Each one of these is false. But in each case, there's a footnote or an asterisk where, under certain circumstances, the answer may be true.
All right. Well, so, spoken like a true lawyer, I'm afraid.
I have to go through those.
All right. Let's start at the top, and that is to talk about the endorsement on a check, because we all do that constantly, and I presume the banks check those for each check very carefully.
In fact, most endorsements are never looked at. With automatic check processing, the check may never even be turned over to look at the endorsement, but that doesn't mean that the endorsement isn't important. But the UCC provides that an endorsement can be in any form, any name, any sign, symbol used by the payee. And that's important because it's not unusual for a check to be issued to somebody in a incorrect spelling of the person's name. My name's spelled with a C, like the beer, not the president, but it's not unusual for me to get checks payable to me without the C. And I can endorse it whatever way I like, although the person receiving the check from me can, in fact, require under the Uniform Commercial Code that I endorse it also exactly in the way it's written.
Now, I do a lot of work in my practice with embezzlements of checks from companies usually by insiders, employees. But, of course, a check can be stolen or lost and picked up by somebody else before I've endorsed it. What's the rule on whether or not somebody signing a check for me falsely could be negotiated and paid by the bank?
That's a very complicated question. It's probably beyond where we can get today. But the bank won't see it. The bank won't be able to discern whether a signature, a scrawled signature, is yours or is somebody impersonating your signature.
Okay. So it still would get paid, presumably?
It would get paid. Now, there would be certainly be opportunities to recover the check later on.
All right. Now let's go to the second question we had put then to our clients here. That is, a check that is over 6 months old will not be paid. In other words, is there a time deadline by which checks go stale?
Checks do go stale after 6 months, but the bank is allowed to pay the check even though it's 9 months or 9 years old. And this is important for the grandparents out there who give checks to grandchildren for birthdays or holidays. Those checks may stay out for a long, long time, but they always are still live instruments, even years later.
I must say it's interesting to me. I thought that there was no time deadline, but you're saying there's a six-month presumption that a check goes stale at that point in time.
But we have to remember that the bank almost never will actually look at the date on the check, so the bank's not going to know. And particularly at the beginning of the year, we have all kinds of checks that are a year old as soon as they're issued because people put in the wrong year. So at the beginning of 2010, many people issued checks dated January blank of 2009.
Sure, so they're already more than a year old technically.
More than 6 months old, but the bank pays them anyway.
And I suppose to be fair to bankers, and many of our finest clients are banks, the answer is that they just can't commercially look at and study every check that gets run through the mill.
Not every detail on the check.
Okay. All right, let's do the third question that we put then before to our listeners, and that is, a check must state the dollar amount in both words and numbers. And I must say, if the answer to this is false, why do they put both of those on the blank form?
Well, the answer is false. There isn't anything in the UCC that says that a check has to be payable or made with the amount shown in both words and numbers, the words, the amounts spelled out in words. But for tradition and for security reasons, we do put it on the check in both ways because it makes it much harder for a crook to alter the amount of the check. So if I have $100 written on my check just in numbers, 100, it's fairly easy for somebody just to add another zero at the end. If I have it written out with $100 and no cents, it's much harder for somebody to convert that to be $1,000 and no cents.
Now, I don't do it very often, but every once in a while I don't necessarily get the number aligned with the words that I've written out. What controls then in that situation, the highest or the lowest?
The UCC actually has an answer for that, and it's a policy choice that I'm not sure I agree with, and the answer is that the words control over the numbers.
Now, why would that be?
The thought is that it took me longer to write the words out. I must have thought about it more, so that's the one that should govern. And although the reality is we simply have to have a choice. We can't have two numbers on a check, and we need to have a way for the bank to be able to figure out which one is which.
So I suppose the real bottom line answer there is that number gets paid is the one that the person enters into their check deposit slip as opposed to even what's on the check.
And that could be as well. But if there's ever a question and the issue comes up, the words spelled out govern over the numbers.
All right. And I know that Denny had a curiosity about this one, the fourth one, but maybe we'll do that after the break here.
We got another mission. Can we set it up, though? And what is the next question?
Well, the check made payable to John and Mary can successfully be negotiated by either of them. The answer here is false. If it does, in fact, say John and Mary, it's multiple payees, each must sign. Now, in reality, the bank may not catch that, but each of them is required to sign. We changed the law a few years ago to say that if there's any ambiguity, then it is treated as an alternative signature and either can sign.
So maybe my wife was fooling me all these years. We have to take a break. We're going to be right back with more Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett here on News 830 WCCO. Hey, good afternoon to you. This early edition of Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett here on 830 WCCU. Denny Long filling in for the vacationing Steve Thompson. And as usual, Tom Schroyer is with us. We've been having some good fun here this past half hour. We'll have some more. Where do we go from here, guys?
Well, we're going to go back to talking about the Uniform Commercial Code with Kevin Bush, dealing with the topic of bank checks, how they work, what the law is that makes them kind of quirky, I guess I'd say. And, Kevin, we're going to return to our list of questions that we posed at the top of the show, and we're on question number five.
Number five is true-false. A post-dated check will not be paid until the date on that check. The answer there is very false. Once a check is out, it may be paid immediately, and the fact that there's a post date on it will probably not be noticed by the bank, and even if it was noticed, the bank can pay it right away.
I mean, Kevin, my non-lawyer's hat says that is just so wrong. That's just not fair. How can that be?
Well, first of all, the bank's not going to know on the post date very easily because it's hard to catch it in the automated clearing process. And there is a process that a customer can use with the bank to actually provide for special treatment for a check to hold it out of the clearing process for a period of time. But that is a special process, and there is a fee associated with it.
And so I'm at the risk of being overdrawn on my account when I give out a post-dated check, and I don't know any better. That again, I just wonder if that isn't really so inconsistent with how most people look at life that it really does seem quite odd. But I guess that's what the law says.
Right.
The law in all of its majesty. Okay. what's the next question? The number six, I'll put it to you, Kevin. A check is good unless it is rejected by the bank before the end of the next business day after it has been presented for payment at the bank? Now, that's a long question with a lot of subparts in it.
We like to have checks paid very quickly. Banks are under a very tough deadline to process all checks that are presented to the bank by midnight of the day after the bank receives the check, the next business day, so weekends aren't counted here. So we like to have them processed very quickly, and customers will sometimes erroneously assume that if the check doesn't bounce by the end of that next day, it's good. And the answer is no, it is not necessarily good.
All right, so what this comes down to is when can I expect and count on a check having cleared if I haven't heard back that it bounced?
Right. And we try to move them through very quickly, but there are any number of circumstances that can result in a delay, including things such as weather or Bruce's snowstorm coming up could result in a delay in processing or a power outage, for instance. But there's a much bigger problem out there, and that is each of these checks, as we talked about last time, has a warranty associated with it regarding proper payment, genuineness, and so on. And those problems can, in fact, result in the check being bounced weeks later, even months or years later.
Now, we talk about warranties in terms of an automobile. We've had the recall. I have a home television set I bought an extended warranty on. What's a bank check warranty, briefly?
There are several warranties built into a check. One of them is that all the signatures are genuine and that there's enough money behind it.
And that's the bottom line for any check, but how could it be rejected? How could a warranty come into play, as you put it, years down the road?
If it turns out that the check is counterfeit, for instance, and the bank didn't catch it initially because it was a very good counterfeit, it may be that that check will bounce a long time after it was initially cleared.
Still, when it all is said and done, is there a normal time frame when we can pretty much be assured that a bank has cleared a check?
I'm always reluctant to give a specific time frame there because there are these delays that can come in.
Sure.
We like to think 5 to 7 days. Some local checks may clear much faster, but the listeners should also be very careful that they shouldn't expect that it will take 5 to 7 days to clear a check. Once a check is out there, it may in fact clear in as early as 24 hours, 12 hours.
And we were talking offline a little bit about how fast credit card companies are able to convert checks into cash these days, and that's, you know, a little bit of a wake-up call for many of us as well.
Because of this hybrid system that we talked about earlier, where checks are converted into electronic payments, they may be processed very, very quickly.
Maybe say a little bit more about how that works, Kevin. I write a check to pay off my credit card bill. I send it in. The credit card company gets it. And then what happens?
The credit card company takes a photo, a copy, electronic copy of the check, and converts the financial information on the check into electronic form and then uses that to process the check going forward as if it were a wire transfer or an automated clearinghouse transfer.
I see. So when you say it was a hybrid transaction, what you meant was that I started it by writing a check, but the credit card company converted it into a wire transfer, which is instantaneous.
Yes.
Now, does that happen in any other parts of our commercial life other than just credit card companies? Are other businesses doing that now?
Yes. Many big check processors, companies that handle lots of checks, utilities, for instance, are going to that approach.
And is that why when I get my statement back from the credit card company, I see this entry for the payment and it looks like a bunch of numbers on the balance?
Certainly that. And on your bank statement, it will show up that same way.
All right, now we're going to go to the final question. We should have a drum roll here, but this is question number 7. And the question is, Kevin Bush, if there is insufficient money in an account to cover all the checks presented on that account on any given day, the bank will pay the biggest checks first. True or false?
The answer is false. The UCC allows the bank to pay the checks in any order. This is an area that's caused a certain amount of controversy because of the consumer protection components associated with it. Checks that bounce cause fees to be assessed by the bank. And if the bank pays the biggest checks, then there will be multiple smaller checks that will bounce, each one of which will incur a fee. But it's very difficult for a bank to figure out which checks a customer would want to be paid first. Would the customer prefer to have all the little checks paid and one big one bounce, or is that big check one that might be the one that would cause the most damage for the customer? So the banks are put in an awkward spot. The answer for the customer, of course, is keep money in the account to cover all the checks whenever they appear.
Now, what happens, though, if the bank picks only the big checks and then all of these little checks, each of them bears an NSF charge? That certainly is going to generate a lot of fees for the bank and be a hardship for the consumer.
It certainly can be, and that is why the issue has caused some controversy. But these NSF checks, that stands for non-sufficient funds, by the way, they are always a problem for the banks. They require manual handling and are very expensive to handle internally.
All right. Now, I have a question. We didn't talk about this before, and it's not on our little outline here, so I hope you'll know the answer. But when I want to sell my used car, and I'm not trading it in, so I'm not protected with the goodwill of the car dealer and the credit of the car dealer, but when I'm selling on a private party transaction, that's a lot of money. I'm letting a car go down the road. I've signed over the title. I'm going to get a check back, and I want to get a cashier's check or a certified check. Does that provide me with any real protection?
It can. Many banks don't like to issue certified checks anymore, so in your case, it would be most likely be a cashier's check, and that is a check issued by the bank. The bank is obligated on the check, and that makes it a very strong instrument. The difficulty we've had recently is that there are a lot of counterfeit cashier's checks in circulation.
Oh, my.
It's very difficult to tell which ones are legitimate and which ones aren't, and it's caused some real opportunities for fraud in the market.
All right, one quick question before we head into the break then. If I take the cashier's check in payment for my used car, can the buyer stop payment on the check and, in effect, force me to come after them?
That's a complicated question. The short answer is no. It is a check issued by the bank, not by your buyer, so that the buyer doesn't have any ability to stop payment. Only the bank has the ability to stop payment.
All right, so some protection there.
All right, very good. Let's take a break here. We'll have more Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett here on News Radio 830 WCCO. And welcome back to this portion of Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett, a check show today. Most interesting, and I have a real quick question on my own, and then I can repose our question that we started the show with. I remember getting a cashier's check on a well-known bank and went into the bank to deposit it, no cash back, just deposit it, and they said it'll take 3 days to clear. Is that part of that fraud business, do you think, that the banks are being just cautious?
It may well have been. There are so many counterfeit cashier's checks floating around that banks are very careful how they are handled.
Okay, it may have been the reason.
So is there anything I should do as a person accepting such a check, again, for my valuable used car, Kevin, before I let the title go?
It's a very tough question. We're very careful with our clients not to accept cashier's checks for transactions that are conducted long distance. If you're dealing with an individual in person, perhaps you can get a little more comfort level that the check is genuine. But it may be that you'll need to call the bank in question and get a confirmation that is in fact a legitimate check before you release your title to your vehicle.
All right. Now, I know we're going to give the long-awaited answer to our question here, our question that we put at the top of the show. So, Denny, do you want to take that?
Let me pose the question once again for those that missed it. And we do have a bunch of answers here. A check may be written only on a check form approved by the bank. A check may be written only on a check form approved by the bank. We could use another drum roll here.
Yes. All right, Kevin. We have our voters. Our voters have been mostly, I think, getting this right, haven't they?
They have. Very good answers.
All right, so we're very proud of our listeners. They got everyone who texted in got the correct answer, which is?
No, the check does not need to be in any particular form.
And so, for example, when I watched The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, this goes back to the 70s, and I saw a guest on there with a bare midriff have a check written on it, that could be a negotiable instrument.
It could be. That brings us to a topic that we couldn't leave untold when we're talking about checks, and that is the case of the negotiable cow.
All right.
Can I get into that now?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. The source of this story is a little bit unclear, and there's a hint that perhaps it was all made up by a British humorist. But as the story goes, perhaps we should call it the tale of the negotiable cow, a disgruntled taxpayer wanted to make a point with the revenue department and took his cow down to the revenue office and painted the check for the tax payment on the side of the cow. The revenue officer refused this. And later on in the trial for non-payment of the taxes, the taxpayer raised as a defense, I paid it. I delivered a check, negotiable instrument for the taxes, and the revenue department refused it. So you can't sue me for non-payment of my taxes. And the judge, after thinking this through for quite a while, said, you're right. This is a negotiable instrument. It was written on the side of a cow, but it's still a negotiable instrument, and it had everything in there. Case dismissed.
That's funny, and perhaps soon to become again a sign of the times here. Who knows?
That's right.
I'd be afraid to ask where it was going to be endorsed.
Well, I'm a city boy, so I don't have to talk about that.
Oh, okay.
All right, Kevin, I know you wanted to move into the final segment here, talking a bit about how banks allocate the question of a loss. Who's going to take the hit when there's a problem check that gets introduced into the system?
We don't have a lot of a high percentage of problem checks, but we do have a lot of them because with billions of checks, even a very small percentage leads to a fair number of checks that have problems. A humorous person such as Tom would say there are really only two rules that we have to use here. The one is that the person who caused the loss is the one to whom the UCC will allocate the loss. Pretty obvious statement. Rule number two is that person's never available. That person's in jail, on the run, unidentified, in bankruptcy. And so what we're left with is allocating this loss to innocent people. It's not an easy task. It's never pleasant. They're complicating factors, and the UCC provides a whole set of these.
So maybe to bring it down to brass tacks, what we're talking about, again, is a situation where somebody has perhaps stolen a check and falsely endorsed it and has run off with the money to Bimini or someplace south.
Correct. And now that check is out there, and somebody needs to take the loss. And the UCC provides a whole set of questions that we go through. And when our clients face these, I ask them to imagine one of these old coin sorting banks. If you remember, these are plastic, clear plastic banks. You put the coin in at the top, and the coin goes through a series of ramps and chutes back and forth, until it falls into a compartment at the bottom. And we do that with our checks, check problems, to try to resolve it and get to the right answer.
And so there are a series of rules that have been worked out. And at the end of the day, the coin falls into the proper slot, and somebody takes the hit. And is that usually the person who last dealt with the thief in this case?
That's one of the most important questions, is the person who had the most recent dealings with the crook or the thief is the one most likely to take the loss.
All right. This is great fun today, you guys. Thank you. What's up next week's show?
Well, we're going to have Kristen Huebner back on the show. Kristen is very exciting. She's a trial lawyer with Moss & Burnett, and she's going to talk about taking a lawsuit from soup to nuts, from start to finish, on lawsuits in a civil damages setting, and it's going to be a lot of fun, Denny.
Excellent. Good to see you again, Tom. Kevin, it was nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.